All right, thank you so much for coming. You are attending session 171, Leonard J. Arrington and his diaries. And my name is Devery Anderson. I'm moderating this session. And just to go over quickly our usual housekeeping stuff here, need to remind you to turn off phones if they are on, and if you're not sure or if you think you're sure, check anyway, because you've always seen the person who thinks their phone's off until it goes off right in the middle of the session. So double check and make sure that they're off or on silent. And we ask that you be respectful and attentive during the session. And it's the mission of Sunstone to host thoughtful and respectful dialogue. We invite all here to practice looking at all Mormon experiences as legitimate Mormon experiences, no matter how diverse they may be. And the session is being recorded, and you'll be able to purchase this after the session ends at the registration desk. And hope you'll take the time also to purchase some books and goods from the vendors scattered throughout the conference center. And remember, too, that on Saturday there'll be a signing for this particular volume, or these volumes, the Arrington Diaries, Saturday from 12:30 to 2. If you purchase these books from, or if you own them or want to purchase them from Benchmark Books, you can get them signed. So there'll be some signature authors at a table for a signing at 12:30 during lunch. So keep that in mind and support that if you can. The session's 90 minutes long, and we ask that both audience and presenters keep within the framework of that time so we can allow for the next session to start on time. This session ends at 6:30. And after the session, many attendees are gathering for a local Crown Burger meal, which is a Utah tradition, apparently. So, and then return on time for the two plenary sessions going on tonight with Marvin Sweeney from Claremont, who'll be presenting about Scripture, and Gina Colvin and Maxine Hanks have prepared a feminist devotional. These presentations, love you to support those. They begin at 7:45. All right, so this presentation with this call as, or about this presentation, with this call as official LDS Church historian in 1972, Leonard J. Arrington was given a mandate to professionalize its historical publications. Arrington's team was prolific and its output impressive, but before long they encountered opposition from a few members of the Quorum of the Twelve Apostles and church bureaucrats. Signature Books, long-awaited 2,600-page Confessions of a Mormon Historian, the Diaries of Leonard J. Arrington, 1971 to 1997, speaks candidly of these clashes, but also provides a lens into the history of Mormonism during the last decades of the 20th century. Readers will also learn about Arrington the man, his family, and his faith. Our panelist, Gary James Bergera, is the editor of the Confessions of a Mormon Historian and is managing editor of the Smith Pettit Foundation and director of publishing at Signature Books, and a member of the board of editors of the Mormon History Association. Christina Rossetti is a doctoral candidate at the Department of Religious Studies at the University of California, Riverside, with an emphasis on Mormonism and spiritualism and alternative forms of Mormon religious practice. In 2017, she was awarded the Mormon Studies Fellowship at the Tanner Humanities Center at the University of Utah. Thomas G. Alexander earned his PhD at UC Berkeley and taught history at BYU for over 40 years, where he was also director of the Charles Redd Center for Western Studies from 1980 to 1982. He's written numerous award-winning books and articles on Mormon and Utah history. And Levina Fielding Anderson is president of Editing Incorporated and has been involved in various editorial roles with the Journal of Mormon History, Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought, the Review of Higher Education, the Mormon Alliance, the Editorial Advisory Board of Signature Books, and the Ensign. All right, so we will hear from our panelists, and then afterwards we'll take questions until 6:30.
In thinking about what might be of interest to most of you regarding the publication of the Diaries of Leonard Arrington, I've decided that rather than attempt to summarize the contents of the diaries, I instead would provide some background into the origins of the project. Discussions with the Arrington family, as represented by Susan Arrington Madsen, the youngest child and only daughter of Leonard and Grace Arrington, regarding the publication of the diaries, began in late 2011. These followed an initial outreach by Arrington family friend Lance Owens. I think the principal goal of these discussions was to gain a better understanding of each party's hopes and expectations. A formal contract between the Smith Pettit Foundation, where I am employed as the managing director, and the Arrington Family Trust was signed on January 10, 2012. At that point, work on preparing the diaries for publication began in earnest. While Arrington maintained diaries prior to late 1971, I decided to focus on those years I believe to be of greatest interest to the majority of readers. Thus, the published version begins shortly before Arrington's appointment as LDS Church historian, which occurred in early 1972, continues through his directorship of the LDS Church History Division and of the Joseph Fielding Smith Institute for Church History, and concludes with the years of his retirement. Though he kept diaries before his appointment as church historian, not until that time did Arrington approach the task of documenting his life with the focus and self-awareness that characterized the undertaking thereafter. Sometime between 1972 and February 1974, Arrington began to assemble, in letter-size, loose-leaf binders, a series of scrapbooks he labeled Diary. These scrapbooks included, among other items, copies of diary entries he had recorded previously. After 1981, Arrington abandoned the scrapbooks, but continued to keep a diary as loose letter-sized sheets. Arrington's papers were acquired by the library at Utah State University in stages, beginning in 1982 and continuing until after Arrington's death in early 1999. As is common practice, the library's special collections staff disassembled the 24 scrapbooks covering the period from birth through 1981 and placed the pages in archival folders and boxes. These diaries today comprise boxes 21 through 35 of Arrington's papers. Boxes 36 through 52 contain the remainder of Arrington's diary from 1982 on. On January 7, 1959, Arrington began to maintain with greater regularity a diary, usually typed. From 1959 through November 1971, Arrington's diary reads mostly like an appointment calendar, with occasional brief annotations or notes to self. However, when it became clear in late 1971 that Arrington's career might take a significant turn, he decided, prompted by son Carl, to document more fully major events in his life. Thereafter, through December 1981, Arrington's diary contains, in addition to Arrington's typed diary entries, an even greater variety of autobiographical materials, including, but not limited to, copies of letters to and from Arrington, minutes of meetings of LDS Church Historical Department executives and managers, internal reports usually generated by the Historical Department, brief excerpts from the diaries of some colleagues, copies of speeches, clippings from newspaper and magazine articles, obituaries, the printed programs of history conferences and similar meetings, local and regional LDS Church bulletins and announcements, public statements and press releases, theater, play, musicals, operas, ballet programs, trip and vacation itineraries, airplane tickets, hotel and restaurant bills, restaurant menus, greeting cards, Christmas cards, birthday cards, miscellaneous memoranda, and scraps of printed and other material Arrington believed to be important. Arrington's shift in how he maintained his diary, beginning in late 1981, early 1982, seems to have been prompted by the gradual redefinition, beginning in 1977-78, of his job from church historian to director of the Church History Division, and his division's subsequent relocation, finalized in August 1982, from the Church Historical Department in Salt Lake City to the newly created Joseph Fielding Smith Institute for Church History at BYU in Provo. Evidently, Arrington came to view his formal diary entries as of decreasing importance given his move away from church headquarters, his diminishing involvement in the daily grind of professional history making, and the approach of his retirement in 1987. As he grew older, especially in retirement, Arrington recorded fewer and shorter diary entries. He continued to insert other material in his diary, but it appears that health, energy, and interest lagged. Also, since he no longer enjoyed secretarial support, what diary entries he did compose, he typically typed himself rather than dictated. What seems to be the last formal diary type entry is dated January 10, 1997, a little more than 2 years before Arrington's death. To an extent before 1997, but especially after, Arrington's regular letters to his children functioned increasingly as the primary chronological narrative of his life, though the focus of the letters was more personal than professional. During the early stages of preparing Arrington's diary for publication, I made two decisions. First, I would not attempt a typographical facsimile reproduction, but rather a clean transcription of the diaries as I believe Arrington intended. This means that instead of tracking all changes to the original text, I silently, without always alerting readers, made all of Arrington's own changes to the text of the diaries. This meant silently transferring to the transcription Arrington's corrections. Second, I extracted all the entries labeled diary, or from context understood to be original diary entries, rather than reproduced the entire contents of the scrapbooks, theater programs, trip itineraries, newspaper and magazine clippings, etc. These clearly identified diary entries, it seemed to me, comprised the actual diary. And the supplementary material Arrington included did not. As the number of explicitly labeled diary entries began to dwindle, however, I incorporated into the diary what struck me as especially relevant excerpts from Arrington's letters to his children. I acknowledge the subjective nature of this decision, but believe the inclusion of such material selected judiciously, I hope, rounds out and completes both the diary and the narrative of Arrington's life. Regarding the identification of people mentioned in the diaries, I tried to annotate using publicly available information the men and women who appeared to be significant in Arrington's life. I did not attempt to identify people whom Arrington mentioned only in passing. Nor did I try to identify all the major events in the person's life, only those that seemed most relevant and most useful in helping to place the person in the context of the diaries. The majority of errors and possibly inadequacies that exist in the annotations will probably be found in the identifications of people. To any who may find the facts of his or her life or the facts of his or her family members misstated or less than fully stated, I apologize in advance. In titling the publication of the diaries Confessions of a Mormon Historian, I drew some inspiration from Arrington himself. One of the possible titles he toyed with for his autobiography, subsequently published in 1998 as Adventures of a Church Historian, was Confessions. I also like and find it appropriate that the verb confess traces back to the Latin confessio, meaning to acknowledge, and may refer specifically to acknowledging one's faith or matters of one's faith. As Gary Wills points out in his brief biography of St. Augustine and his confessions, quote, "The term that best covers this range of meanings for confessio is testimony," end quote. Thus, and despite confessions' corollary as admitting to transgression, etc., I think confessions as testimony accurately represents the contents of the diaries. The published version of the Arrington Diaries represents the combined efforts of many people in addition to myself. These include, but are not limited to, artist Parshall, who prepared a preliminary typescript of the diaries based on scans of the original supplied by the Arrington family, Susan Arrington Madsen, who proofed the entire annotated typescript several times and kindly provided the foreword, Becky Bartholomew, who adapted her several studies of Arrington into a standalone biographical introduction that situates for readers Arrington prior to his appointment as LDS Church historian, Christine Rigby Arrington, Richard Jensen, and Brian Buchanan, who each separately proofed the entire manuscript and caught more than a few errors, Levina Fielding Anderson and Joseph Geisner, who provided the chronology, Thomas G. Alexander, who wrote for this publication his own personal reminiscence of Arrington, Jeff Johnson, who compiled a bibliography of Arrington's publications, Brad Cole and members of the staff at Special Collections, Utah State University Library, Janie Fleet and members of the staff of Signature Books, including Ron Prittis, John Hatch, Devery Anderson, Keiko Jones, and designer Jason Francis, If you like the look of the diaries, that's all Jason, and George Smith and the Smith Pettit Foundation, who gave me the time to work on the diaries. As I contemplate the diaries, I have come to believe that the careful reading of them will bring the reader as close to knowing another person as is possible. I have also come to believe that every reader's experience with the diaries will be different. I'd like to conclude with two non-spoilerish readings from Arrington's writings. They are both from Arrington's letters to his children, and both were written on dates after the period of time covered in the published diaries, and so do not appear in the publication. The first is the last letter Arrington ever wrote, and is dated January 29, 1999. At the time, Arrington was in the hospital and dictated the following to his daughter, Susan. I think it summarizes well Arrington's orientation to life and interest in chronicling an accurate history. It reads, "Dear children, I got to thinking the other day something that sounds strange is that when I was looking after chickens on the Twin Falls, Idaho farm, the chickens used to get lice, and I used to put on the roosts a liquid that seeps up from the roost and kills all the lice. Apparently, in going through all this, I myself picked up lice. And I can remember lice in my hair and buying a little narrow comb. I could pick up any lice that was there. It helped me realize what a pretty bad health status we were in. We picked up tainted typhoid fever. In fact, I had it at least twice. Both times from tainted ditch water, which we drank all year. It had come from where cows had sloshed, human beings had defecated, and birds had left their droppings. Susie wants to know why I didn't get cholera, but none of us ever did. But of course, we did get in succession mumps, whooping cough, scarlet fever, diphtheria, measles, both red and German, and the flu. Something else I thought of in those days was our annual honeybee honeycomb harvest. In the process, several of us would get stung by bees and go around for 2 or 3 days with swollen eyes and or neck. My grandpa, Leroy Arrington, always had several hives of bees. One year, my father planted alfalfa, not clover, in his field, and he was told that in order to pollinate the alfalfa seeds as it came along, he acquired several beehives. I liked them, too, because bees used to eat my favorite hollyhock in the front yard. Anyway, lots of excitement from honey, honeycomb, and getting acquainted with bees. It's very difficult to explain to young people today in the LDS Church that they do not have the same opportunities for self-expression that they had when I was a boy. My first talk was at a state conference, was a state conference talk on tithing when I was 9 years old. When I was 12, I gave several, one on Brigham Young and one on the Boy Scouts and at least two others, one on controlling your temper. Every year from then on, from age 13, more talks, age 14, more talks, age 15, more talks. I might say that different from many young people today, I always wrote out my talks and memorized them. So whenever I gave a talk, it sounded as though I was just talking or explaining. I think I did not give a talk that wasn't memorized until I went off to college, and then only because I was part of a debate team. I'm grateful to Susie for this dictation. One of these days, I hope to type my own. Love, Dad. The second reading is dated a year earlier, February 11, 1998, and I believe it best encapsulates Arrington's tendency to nostalgia as well as his hopeful view of the larger world. It reads, "Sometimes my work is such that I take my walk at night, up and down 22nd East Street, and sometimes up 22nd and down to Oneida Street, and up to 21st South, and then back home on 22nd East. The windows in the houses glow, as do the street lights and the row of lights we erected a couple of years ago on every other house next to the street. I see the windows shivering with gold and amber, and our yard lights, strong and beautiful assertions of the light. As I crush the thick caked snow under my shoes, I do not wear boots, I think of my children and grandchildren, good thoughts, beautiful thoughts, satisfying thoughts. You are all like lights, lights to my mind, to my soul, to my life." An article in a magazine reminds us of Alfred Hitchcock's Foreign Correspondent, the end of which is a scene in which the radio station goes out during the Blitz. And Joel McRae calls into the mic, "Hello, America, hang on to your lights. They're the only lights left in the world." John Milton died blind, out of the light. A last writing was, "When I consider how my light is spent," maybe he meant life. Goethe's reported last words were, "More light." Do you remember the song we used to sing as children? "This little light of mine, I'm going to let it shine." You did. Have you ridden in an airplane at night? and noticed how much dark space there is between the necklaces of light. Sometimes I hate to end my walk when I'm traveling late at night. Many lights went out, but there was always in my mind the lights that came from you. Thank you for the opportunity to have been able to share some of my thoughts regarding the editing of the diaries of Leonard Arrington.
All right, so thank you so much for being at this panel. I'm so grateful to be able to speak on these diaries. Through reading these diaries and speaking on panels about them, I've developed a deep admiration for Arrington and his vision of church history. And today, I'm honored to, again, participate in a panel alongside people that Arrington knew and name-dropped a lot in his diaries. So I gave this talk at the King's English Bookstore, so if you were there for that, I'm really sorry you have to sit through it again. I'm not Mormon. I've never been. I'm a Catholic convert who read Rough Stone Rolling and became captivated by Joseph Smith and the story of the Restoration. From that point on, Mormonism was my greatest passion and interest. After reading Bushman, I proceeded to read every book I could find about Mormonism and declare it the focus of my graduate career and the future subject of my dissertation writing. I remember the first year after I decided I was going to study the church, I would go to conferences or receptions and tell people that I studied Mormonism when they asked what I did. At my response, countless people would stare at me and reply, "Did they let you do that?" I was confused by this response. Why wouldn't they let me? I had spent countless hours in LDS meeting houses, and I graduated from institute, so the idea of being unable to study the history of the Restoration seemed strange. That summer, I came to Utah and spent weeks in the church history library looking through documents. I remember the first time I came across the phrase, "closed to research." I had come to develop a love for William Godbey, the church he was excommunicated from, the movement he started, that to see those words next to his diaries was disheartening, to say the least. In fact, my favorite building in Utah is the one that holds the Beer Hive Pub downtown. You should all go to it. It was designed by E.L.T. Harrison, one of Salt Lake City's most famous architects and Godbeites. However, despite certain restrictions, the historical chapter of my dissertation was completed that summer using primary documents from the church archive. During that summer, the church history library became one of the spaces I felt most welcome in Utah, where Jennifer Barkdahl would remember my name and say hello, and Mike Quinn would look up from his computer to give me a hug. A non-Mormon, using documents from individuals labeled apostate, felt welcome studying church history in the church history library. I tell you this story because there was a time when those colleagues at conferences and receptions would have been right, when that would have not been possible. My ability to study church history and research the various saints of the Restoration is possible because of Leonard Arrington and his legacy. Leonard Arrington's diaries reveal a man who stood as a catalyst for a new era in church history. Unlike the church historians who came before him, Arrington was a trained professional historian with a PhD in economics from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. At the same time, he was a faithful Latter-day Saint whose life was changed upon reading such books as Joseph Smith, An American Prophet. Balancing these worlds proved to be Arrington's greatest challenge. Time and again, his diaries reflect a man caught in the middle of producing professional history worthy to stand alongside the other great historical research of the time and promoting a faithful image of the saints that would bolster the testimonies of the faithful. On December 7, 1975, Arrington affirmed this struggle when he wrote, "If we survive this year, we shall have proved, as I believe we can, that church history can be excitingly written and still be basically faith-promoting, that at the same time, professionally and intellectually respectable. I pray that this may be true and that we can measure up both to our devout friends and to our professional colleagues." During Leonard's service as church historian, the goal of a more honest and open history was made tangible with a more open archive. Despite being the first historian to receive unrestricted access, the openness became a consistent point of contention among Arrington and general authorities, because an open archive is dangerous. Open archives free the people of the past to be their authentic selves, full of messiness and complexity. The saints are no longer mere reflections of perfection, but struggling humans reaching out toward their God as they toil to build Zion. Brigham Young was no longer a one-dimensional prophet. He was also a man who chewed tobacco and had imperfect sons. This tobacco story, though simple, is referred to numerous times throughout the diaries and is illustrative of Arrington's struggle over what stories were told and what tone they were told in. When questioned about including this detail of Young's life, Arrington affirmed that it would be included in his biography because it was part of Young's life and character. Arrington wanted history of real people, as he said, warts and all. As someone who has been labeled anti-Mormon for promoting and practicing this kind of history, I am proud to say that I stand within a tradition that Leonard Arrington laid the groundwork for, a tradition of honest history that affirms that offers historical figures the same thing we all want, fairness in the midst of our flaws. But a closed archive is equally dangerous. Throughout the diaries, Arrington makes mention of anti-Mormons who are printing unpublished sermons and historical details of the church. And it's my favorite part of the archive because it's Fred Collier and Sandra Tanner together. And Fred Collier is the most Mormon person. He's a fundamentalist who took Mormonism to an 11. So putting him and Sandra Tanner together is, I think, hilarious. And so they were publishing historical details of the church, and it became a weaponizing of secrecy. Because if one group doesn't make something available, another certainly will. When the department was moved outside the church office building, Arrington spoke of concern that non-Mormon and anti-Mormon friends will get to say, "I told you so." For those in church leadership who believed history had to either be right or anti-Mormon, a closed archive and limit to church-endorsed publications was safe. However, in one of the most challenging times for the production of church history, Arrington knew better and continued in his never-ending quest of history that is both true and faithful. For that, we can all be grateful. Leonard Arrington is candid, sometimes shockingly so, about the struggles as church historian. He frequently wrote of certain brethren not supporting his approach and shutting down projects. On November 11, 1980, while reflecting on recent events in church bureaucracy, Arrington expressed frustration that, "It has been disturbing to me in recent months to see evidences that some church officers do not want the church to promulgate historical truth." This struggle was not new, but gained intensity as his time in church history progressed. However, through opposition from the brethren, battles with church bureaucracy, changes in his title and calling, and a departmental move from the church office building to the Joseph Fielding Smith Institute at BYU, Arrington was unwavering in his belief that history should be honest and objective. For Arrington, Mormonism needs history because it's a historical religion marked by the divine breaking into time and space to interact with the living. In this way, history itself is deeply sacred, and something is missing in Mormon doctrine if history is not included. As an ethnographer, one particular moment of openness in the archive stood out to me. Mark Leone is an anthropologist who in 1972 gained access to restricted High Council trial minutes related to sexual offenses, property ownership, and power struggles between church individuals. Mark was not then, and is not now, a Mormon. To Arrington's knowledge, he was the first to study Mormonism from an anthropological lens, something Arrington found both insightful and valuable. He was one of the original interdisciplinarians in the field. Arrington's entry about Mark is indicative of the new era in church history that Arrington was at the forefront of, an era where the archive is open to both insiders and outsiders to investigate the sacred histories of the past. On numerous occasions in the church history library, I have overheard many people excitingly enter into the reading rooms and fumble over microfilm machines, it's a disaster, as they anticipate reading the diaries of their ancestors. These people are not necessarily scholars. They might not even be faithful members of the church. They're just people, interested in the sacred history of the past because the past is part of who they are. As a Catholic, I can only hope that my church will one day allow the same. From a non-academic perspective, I'm grateful that Leonard Arrington's diaries present the sincere details of Arrington's life. In a time when so many struggle to navigate their beliefs in light of challenging questions about church history, I hope that these diaries will act as a lighthouse to show people a way forward toward a belief that may not be black and white, but is nevertheless meaningful and fulfilling. Throughout his writings, he affirmed that it has been his conviction since childhood that the church is true. However, like many, he came to find that what that means changed over time. He writes, "In the Mormon epic, one may believe in the first vision without worrying unduly as to whether God and Jesus literally appeared in person to Joseph Smith, or whether he thought he saw them in a mystical sense. Did the plates of the Book of Mormon exist in a concrete, literal sense, or did they exist in a symbolic sense? I feel comfortable either way." While a potentially radical assertion, I am hopeful that these words will be a catalyst for renewed conversations on the boundaries of Mormon belief and orthodoxy. One of the things I appreciate most about the diaries is that, much like his historical writing, Arrington's diaries present a warts-and-all approach to his own life. Like his characters, he was not one-dimensional. While he hired women and fought to keep women employed during the duration of their pregnancy, something the church did not allow previously, he also spoke of his struggles, his anger, his illness, and his flaws. I would be remiss if I did not mention my own visceral reaction at his quick remarriage and his often flippant comments on liberals toward the end of his life. But that's what good history does. It offers truthful accounts, even when it's hard and something we don't want to do. I want to end with one more story that involves someone who made frequent appearances in his diaries. A few months ago, I got to spend time in Short Creek, the historic town of home of the FLDS and one of my favorite places in the world. Really, you should go and get the iced coffee. It's great. I know, it's the weirdest thing, but it's so good. During the weekend, Carolyn Pearson served as the keynote speaker for Sunstone Short Creek and performed Mother Woe of the Morning in the old FLDS Sunday School building for a room full of fundamentalists. Having spent the last 2 weeks reading the diaries, I knew Arrington loved her and that she felt the same. He praised her work time and again and expressed concern at the removal of her work from the Ensign because of her public support of ERA. Over the weekend, I shared bits of her diary and listened to her stories of their close friendship. Toward the end of our time together, she told me about a gift that she had sent Arrington, small cards that read, "History is on our side as long as we control the historians." Yeah, that's great. Arrington clearly took this gift to heart because on August 29th, 1986, he wrote, "On the one hand, there are forces that want to protect historical sources for use only by those who will be sure to give a positive interpretation. On the other hand, there are also parties believe the full and honest reporting of the evidence will lend credibility and will, in the long run, prove advantageous for the church. On the one hand, history is on our side. Let the consequences follow. On the other hand, it is only on our side as long as we control the historians." History does have consequences. It is also a force of vindication. For the struggling, the marginalized, those subjected to what Arrington referred to as the Church Inquisition of 1983, the men involved in the events surrounding the 1886 revelation, those who felt the blunt force of church leadership in the form of excommunication during the beginning of a new era in Mormon studies. In life, Arrington knew this. It is my belief that in his death, these diaries will also be part of the vindicating force of history. Thank you.
Instead of writing a talk today, I want to talk about my friend Leonard Arrington. A number of people have said that Leonard really wasn't an active Latter-day Saint. I consider that to be nonsense. I first met Leonard when he was a member of a stake presidency, the Utah State University stake, and an active Latter-day Saint. Leonard was active throughout his entire life. When I first went to Utah State, Leonard was in Genoa teaching and then learning Italian. And it's something that he loved throughout his entire life. I took George Ellsworth's course in Utah history, and at that time there was no textbook for Utah history. George gave us the option of using Leonard Arrington's Great Basin Kingdom or Mulder and Mortensen's Among the Mormons. Well, I read both of them, and I've used them both in my Utah history class at BYU. When Leonard returned the next year, I took his class in United States Economic History, and I found it an exciting class and an interesting one. I came to know Leonard, and he hired me the next summer to write a history of the Utah State University stake. The stake had been organized by the church because the church leadership was concerned about young people, young single adults who were leaving the church. And Leonard wanted to find out how it had come into being and how successful it was. After I finished doing that, I worked on several other projects with Leonard while I was at Utah State. And when I left to go to Berkeley, he told me that he would hire me again at some time. Well, throughout the year, I'd heard nothing from him. My wife and I talked about what we might do during the next summer and about the possibility of my working on construction. Now, do I look like somebody who ought to be working on construction? Well, it was serendipity. One day I was in the library at Berkeley, and who should I happen to run into but Leonard Arrington? And I reminded him that he had said that he might hire me again sometime in the summer. And he said, well, yes, I want to do that, and I've got a grant to write a history of the defense installations in Utah. Well, I went home and talked with Marilyn about that, and she was very much opposed to that idea. She was teaching high school at Miramonte High School in Orinda, and my university experience would end before her experience of teaching. And for the only time in our married life, I insisted that I take the job with Leonard. And I think that Marilyn was happy about that when it finally worked out. So what would happen is that each summer I would drive back to Utah in her car, and she would come back a couple of weeks later on the train. During that period, we wrote a number of articles on all of the defense installations in Utah, and Leonard worked on those the way he did most of his projects. His experience came out of economics rather than history, and ordinarily what would happen is that I would research the article and write a draft, and then Leonard would work on it, and it would appear under both of our names. Well, by the time I had finished my graduate experience at Berkeley, I had 6 articles published. Now, that happens sometimes now, some graduate students, but it was unusual in the 1960s for that to happen. And it helped me to get a job. I was offered positions both at Fresno State University and Brigham Young University. Because Brigham Young wanted me to work in Utah history and Western history rather than California history, I went there. And I think that Leonard played an important part in convincing Gene Campbell, who was a friend of his, that he ought to hire me at Brigham Young University. We worked together with a number of other historians in organizing the Mormon History Association in December of 1965. Each year, the presidents of the various universities, led out by our president, held sessions called the Utah Conference on Higher Education, at which they harangued the faculty members about how much they ought to pay attention to the presidents of the various universities. Well, instead of going to those sessions, we held a rump session. Leonard Arrington, George Ellsworth, Jim Allen, Richard Bushman, Gene Campbell, and we decided we were going to organize the Mormon History Association. We did so then in December of 1965 at the St. Francis Hotel. It was made up not only of Mormons, but of members of the what was then Reorganized Church, now Community of Christ, people who belonged to neither of those traditions, like Merle Wells, who was director of the Idaho State Historical Society, and we chose Leonard as president. In 1972, in addition to becoming church historian, Leonard was given the Lemuel Hardison Red Jr. Professorship at Brigham Young University, and he became director of the Charles Red Center for Western Studies. Now, because he was also a church historian, he needed somebody to be in Provo handling the day-to-day affairs of the Red Center, and he asked me to do that. Again, Leonard affected my professional career. Leonard and I consulted on what we were doing. We planned a monograph series, a lecture series, an oral history program. We planned grants to scholars. And some people have said, well, Leonard wasn't really involved in the Red Center. That's not true. There wasn't anything that we did at the Red Center that Leonard Arrington wasn't involved in. Leonard affected me also in the way he directed the church history department as a church historian. He asked me to write one of the histories, was published later as Mormonism in Transition, part of a 16-volume history. Some of those volumes have appeared, others have not. At the time that some of us finished our manuscripts, the First Presidency and Quorum of the Twelve couldn't agree on publishing the whole series. And so we were asked to sign contracts that gave Deseret Book the right to publish all of the volumes eventually, but then we were left free to publish those volumes wherever we could find a publisher. Richard Bushman and I found University of Illinois interested in publishing our books. Richard's on Joseph Smith's life before the church was organized, and mine dealing with the period from 1890 to 1930 in church history. In 1980, as has been indicated, Leonard moved to BYU as director of the Joseph Fielding Smith Institute for Church History. He couldn't be director of two organizations at BYU, so again, Leonard's decision affected my life in that I became director of the Red Center. Leonard affected my life in other ways as well. I appreciated Leonard's faith, which affected my faith as well. He had an influence on my testimony and my experiences in the church. Leonard died on February the 11th of 1999. Harriet, his wife at that time, called me and asked if I would speak at his funeral. She said that Leonard had rewritten his funeral program 5 times and that I was the only one who appeared in every version. I'm not sure what that meant. But I had the privilege of speaking at his funeral. President Hinckley called up Harriet and asked to be put on the program. So I had the privilege of speaking at the same program as President Hinckley, Davis Bitten, his daughter, Susan Arrington Madsen, Heidi Swinton, who was a daughter of Harriet's and a neighbor. Joanne Ottley sang, "O mio babbino caro," from Puccini's Gianna Schicchi. Leonard loved Italy. He loved the Italian language. And he loved the church. I'm honored to consider myself a friend of Leonard Arrington. And I'm looking for the time in the far distant future when I'll have the privilege of meeting him again. Thank you.
Well, if you've been sitting in sessions all day, you will greet with rapture my proposal that everybody stand up and stretch for 30 seconds. Okay, don't get carried away. I want to thank everybody for being here because the number of bodies in this room has raised the temperature above Arctic. The Leonard Arrington Diaries are a rich and detailed source about one man's experience in Salt Lake City for about the last 25 years of the 20th century. Despite his title, Leonard Arrington was not one of the central movers and shakers of Utah events or even LDS church events. I've tried to think of comparable diaries. Wilford Woodruff was resolutely an official historian to the degree that he minimized references to his family and his profession while assiduously recording sermons, meetings, and even gossip that involved Joseph Smith and, over a longer span of years, Brigham Young. But except for the years he was living in Salt Lake City as church historian, he seems to have been on the fringes of Quorum of the Twelve and First Presidency activities. The same description applies, in my opinion, to George Q. Cannon's diaries, now available, although I have certainly not plumbed their depths. I prefer the diaries of George's son, Abram H. Cannon, partly because they are decidedly more personal and present a better-rounded image of his life. Also, quite a lot of good gossip. Emmeline B. Wells kept a fascinating and strongly revelatory diary, one that invites psychological analysis, but which separates her personal and her professional life. Helen Mar Kimball Whitney's diary, kept during the closing years of her life, records personal lamentations and fears, and Leonard's diaries resemble hers in one respect, I believe, in that they were both interested and keen observers from the margins of the power figures in Mormon history and governments. The fact remains, however, that until and unless the personal diaries of current general authorities become available, Leonard's diary may be the closest record we have access to of what was going on in downtown Salt Lake City during the 1970s and 1980s especially. As a result, I have found myself drawn back repeatedly to the question of Leonard's leadership. He has been called a historical entrepreneur rather than a historian per se. He has been criticized for what seems to be ineptitude in working in a bureaucracy, an inability or lack of interest in building the kinds of relationships to the true power figures who could have defended him against his all too real enemies in church bureaucracy. The conclusion from this perspective is that he was naive in managing his department, with the result that it was booted to BYU with virtually no effective resistance. I want to underscore the fact that I was never a member of Leonard's history division, and those who held that relationship might very well have agreed with the critiques. I was Leonard's part-time employee for several months while the division was being shut down and moved, assigned to draft an autobiography, a ghostwritten autobiography, that became more of a biography, Doves and Serpents. I assumed that Leonard would be editing it fairly heavily, so I did not make strenuous efforts to channel Leonard's voice or present the information drawn from his diary and correspondence in an even-handed and objective way. I loved Leonard, resented the way he was being treated, and by church officers and bureaucrats, and no doubt read much of my own situation. I had been fired by the ensign just before Leonard hired me, into Leonard's own life. For whatever reason, and I never asked Leonard for clarification, this manuscript was printed under my byline, even though it was a work for hire, not an independent project. I saw three characteristics as dominant in Leonard's leadership. First, he had a clear vision of Mormon history as benefiting from the tools of academic training, completeness in exploring the record, sympathy, but as much accuracy as possible in establishing its reconstruction of the past and transparency of the author's stance. This vision dominates Leonard's work and his repeated efforts to describe the work of his division. Some of those explanatory efforts were to the members of his division, but he also saw himself as the voice of his division. I think this point does not require more detailed exposition on my part. Second was Leonard's phenomenal networking interests. He played a major role, perhaps the major role, in building ties with historians in what is now the Community of Christ, and in founding and fostering the Mormon History Association, as Tom has explained. He also energetically recruited and mentored other scholars, not only Tom and his counselors Jim Allen and Davis Bitten, but young graduate students who, he obviously hoped, would become the core of another generation of Mormon historians. That dream was delayed, but it has clearly been realized already in the Joseph Smith Papers Project and the bright, academically trained individuals who have made this project their chief work. One spinoff was how willingly those young scholars Leonard mentored followed his example of freely sharing their own discoveries. Ron Watt and his wife Barbara served a welfare services mission in our ward after Ron's retirement. Ron told me that Leonard, sitting next to him on an airplane, encouraged him to apply for employment even before he finished his graduate work. Ron did, and it led to his career in the archives, where he helped scores of other scholars find and check the accuracy of their sources. Alan Roberts, who recently retired from his architectural firm that had amassed an impressive record in designing and or restoring dozens of LDS meeting houses and temples, told me that he was an undergraduate at BYU whose architectural program was closed down overnight as a result of controversy over the demolition of the Colville Tabernacle. Alan assigned himself the task of driving his battered car over Utah's battering back roads to find and photograph LDS meeting houses, most of them in jeopardy as a result of the church's affluence and the willingness of the church building department to destroy historic buildings and replace them with a standard plan substitute. After Leonard saw him doing research in the archives, he sat down next to Alan and asked what he was doing. When Alan explained, Leonard said, "Nobody else is doing this. I'll get you a grant." He did, and, said Alan, the result of that five-minute conversation changed my life. The third aspect of Leonard's leadership that I celebrate was his optimistic cheerfulness, even when circumstances were dire. From my perspective, this attitude of seeing the best in every situation freed his colleagues and employees to continue to devote their energy to their professional work rather than finding it drawn into worry and speculation. According to his diary, but not to his colleagues, he confessed, "At the time of my appointment as church historian, and indeed many years earlier, I'd had an unshakable conviction that it was possible, if a man was clever enough, to write professional history which would be accepted as such by the profession and at the same time acceptable by the intelligent LDS reader. My confidence in that conviction has been shaken during the past few months." Instead of merely pouring out his lamentations, Leonard went on to analyze and explain his revised conviction by identifying three groups that would reject professional history, no matter how carefully, discreetly, and judiciously written. The first group was the lunatic fringe, which he typified as the John Birch Society and their sympathizers. I think this first group has been largely won over by the Joseph Smith Papers Project, since they have no way of explaining why the church would house and underwrite so gigantic a project, even though anecdotes still hit the blogger knackle of Sunday school teachers released from their positions for quoting the gospel essays. The second group Leonard identified consisted of general authorities who were overprotective of tender testimonied members, especially the young, and reacted defensively to the acknowledgement of any unpleasant facts. I don't think they realized that the best defense against shaking somebody's testimony was to put them in contact with Leonard, that he was a model those tender testimonied people could follow without hesitation. The third group was bureaucrats who picked up and magnified the fears of the general authorities and tried to police expressions that they thought someone will not like something about Mormon history and therefore squelched any indication of acceptance. Leonard summarized, "It is not that they disapprove of me as church historian. They would disapprove of any professional historian, any intellectual, any educated person, any independent-minded writer." Although this last sentence is perhaps too sweeping, I think it accurately expresses Leonard's level of frustration. Seeking to understand the generally hostile work environment, he recorded the many compliments and enthusiastic praise for publications of the History Division, but also traced the disappointment of not having those compliments seep through the bureaucracy with the speed that any word of displeasure did. "There is no public recommend," he observed, "since such a reprimand could be defended against and answered. More perniciously, these objections lead to a kind of unconscious self-censorship, not only on our part, but on the part of others who write or furnish the raw materials on which we base our narratives." I'm sure that current historians working for the church or the church education system run into enough roadblocks to make them limp on stubbed toes, but I suggest that reading Leonard's diary will help them appreciate the privileges and support they currently enjoy. And rather than ending on this rather gloomy note, I'm going to quote a more typical moment that Leonard vastly enjoyed, the performance of a takeoff on a Gilbert and Sullivan Patter song that resulted from the collaboration between my former roommate, Jill Mulvey-Durr, and my husband, Paul. As an act of mercy, I will not try to sing it. "I am the very model of a modern church historian in matters economical, doctrinal, and folklorian. I know the Mormon leaders, and I write their prosopography with research that enlarges and illumines their biography. I've studied men and women, both quixotic and mercurial. I tend to favor those like me, somewhat entrepreneurial. I've drawn my own conclusions about Brigham Young's maturity and analyzed investments of the Eccles First Security. I've also dabbled quite a little bit in social history. The arts and letters of the saints provide a lot of grist for me. Since I can chant, 'Come, come, ye saints,' just like a true Gregorian, I am the very model of a modern church historian. I'm very good at research, and I know historiography as well as hermeneutics and statistical demography. I know the folklore, the three Nephites and Jim Bridger's ears of corn, the so-called White Horse prophecy and Porter Rockwell's locks unshorn. I'm awfully well acquainted, too, with matters economical. In this great basin kingdom, throughout all its chronological development, I understand its finances and enterprise. I've counted everything in sight from Sunday eggs to railroad ties. I'm very well acquainted, too, with issues in theology. I understand statistics, mystics, and phenomenology. Since I can Bible bash with any institute scriptorian, I am the very model of a model church historian. In fact, when I can write a book devoid of all tendentiousness, accept awards and accolades without the least pretentiousness, when I have learned the ins and outs of writing up a grant request, when I explain with utmost tact polygamy post-manifest, when I can smell a controversy brewing and put up my guards, when I can spot a phony salamander at 100 yards, when I am granted access to the archives of the DUP, then I'll deserve a pardon and an honorary PhD. When I learn that I need much more than a scholar's normal bag of tricks, especially a healthy grasp of bureaucratic politics, in matters economical, political, folklorian, I'll be the very model of a modern church historian. Thank you.
Thanks so much to the panel, and now we'll turn it over to you for Q&A. As I said, we have until 6:30, so if you just line up here, and we'll take you in order, and if it's getting close to 6:30 and you're back a few notches, you probably need to ask them afterwards or something, because we need to end on time.
Thanks. Even though I still feel young, I'm not really young anymore, but I still don't have a lot of time. So is there a plan to get the diaries in audio form, audiobook form, and when would that happen? So I can listen to it from back and forth to work as I do all the other podcasts.
I'll answer that. But before that, let me just mention something that happened that none of you know about probably. As Devery was meeting with us before the session began and was going over some of the details about, you know, how long and things like that, he asked us if we wanted to speak from our seats, and Lavina immediately said, I think I would rather speak from my heart. So Signature right now is experimenting with audiobooks. We right now are 0-2. If any of you want to know the details about how you go about doing audiobooks, I'd be happy to talk to you about that afterwards. So let us figure out how to do this first, and then we'll look at the possibility of something like The Arrington Diaries as an audiobook.
So much has been written by Leonard Arrington and about him. What would a reader find in the three volumes that isn't already out there in the public record? Is there a multitude of things? I'm glad to see you respond that way.
Yes. The answer is yes.
The answer is yes.
For me, there was what actually struck me as really interesting, because I just didn't know about this beforehand. I'd had some experience before with Levina's Doves and Serpents, and Levina's Doves and Serpents, and also with his own autobiography, his memoirs, yes. And he talks about some of the details of his experience as the church historian. For me, what was especially interesting, because I just didn't know about this before working on the diaries, was the personal side to his life, and especially his life after his wife, Grace, passed away. I think that there's a side to Arrington there, a much more human side, that becomes apparent as you work your way through the entries.
And then just to follow up.
One other thing, I think, is that the diaries flesh out a lot of things that are simply mentioned in his autobiography and in Greg Prince's biography of Leonard, and Gary Topping's discussion of Leonard. There's just so much that's fleshed out in the diaries that provides information and background that simply cannot be done in a one-volume history.
He lets you know where his favorite fettuccine Alfredo restaurant is. And his favorite color is blue.
All right, then just to follow up. When he's telling the story of the move down south, to BYU, does he name names of which apostles
yes.
Made it necessary? Okay, thank you very much. I'll buy it for sure.
So first off, I just want to thank all of you for not only your work in compiling this huge, monumental task, as well as publicizing it. This is, I think, really important for the next generation of Mormon historians to understand the impact of Arrington. And dovetailing off of that, with that in mind, I know historians are loath to speculate, but I hope that you will suspend that dread for just a second to illustrate to the next generation of historians who may be here or who may be listening in the backlogs, where do you think the realm of Mormon history would be today without Leonard Arrington? And feel free to opine on that in whatever direction you would like. Thank you.
I haven't any idea. All I can say is that I can't think of anyone over the last 50 years who's affected Mormon history more than Leonard Arrington did. And if you subtracted him from that, I suspect it would have been enormously different.
I'm guessing that one of the big game changers that occurred, and this was independent of Arrington, was the internet. So yeah, that's a really good question, you know, but factoring in the internet, it's hard to know. Maybe things wouldn't have been that different from how they are today. But everything that we see, I think, is the result of Arrington and the people who worked with Arrington in the History Division and also in the archives and the library and sites.
I just want to make the point, which Tom has already made, that Leonard was an example of someone who was both faithful and professional. And he made it possible for every Mormon historian who is currently presenting himself or herself as faithful and professional to have a slot in the universe of Mormon history. And I think that that cannot be underestimated.
The other thing, and was something I mentioned in my previous discussion, Leonard provided a model for many of us. I remember talking with Bob Flanders. Some of you may know Bob. He said he was at a conference and Leonard was there. They didn't know each other. Leonard walked up to him with his hand out and said, "Hello, I'm Leonard Arrington." And one of the things that had happened before Leonard gave us that model was that Mormon historians tended to stay among themselves and to stand back and not be involved in meeting with those who weren't other Mormons. And I think Leonard provided a model of reaching out to others. He was president of a number of historical organizations, and there are others who followed his example.
Well, we've talked about these wonderful diaries. I'm just curious, is there any place that they could be obtained at the symposium? Or I'm just curious.
Okay, just for the, for people who are listening to this recording... That was Kurt Bench.
Well, following up on what Tom said, I was one of those early RLDS historians who got involved in the MHA. And in 1971, Paul Edwards came into my office and said, "How would you like to drive out to Salt Lake, out to Provo with myself and church historian Dick Howard and my brother Lyman?" Well, I wasn't really interested in church history at that point. I was interested in history of religion in America, but hadn't really focused on Mormonism. But I thought, 40 hours in the car with those characters? Yeah, I'll go for sure. And at that time, I think the only people Leonard probably knew in the RLDS historical community were Flanders, Bob Flanders, and probably, I'm sure, Dick Howard, too. Was Dick and I and Paul and Lyman. And so we got there, joined by Mark McKiernan. And it was being kind of, it was a big lecture hall in BYU in the old-fashioned theater seats. So the five of us shy RLDS folks went back and sat in the back row, of course. Leonard walks in a little bit later. There's long in a big room. He sees us back there. And his eyes light up. He comes charging back, and he goes to the row in front of us and walks down that row and shakes our hand and then says, "Move over." And he climbs over the seats. And gets in the middle of us, and he just started asking us question after question. And every time we saw him, he was just full of questions. What are we doing? What are you publishing? And so forth. And we all love Leonard, and I think we all owe a whole lot to him. And even though we're writing about different things generally than the LDS historians, he was fantastic. And the last time I saw him was just a few months before he died at Sunstone. He'd been to Sunstone the last quite a few years, and he was still the same old Leonard. You know, very late in his life, and yet he was just still big smiles, lots of questions. He was soldiering on right to the end. So he was a model.
I think Paul, that was Bill Russell, who still may not be a Mormon historian. if he finishes his book on Mormons, on the RLDS schism.
You're going to be seeing it within a year.
Well,
it's a 30-year developing story.
How many years have we heard that? I just wanted to quote Paul Edwards as saying that he wanted Leonard to be his God in the next life.
One thing that Bob Flanders said to a number of us in one of those late night sessions, he said, "You fellows have really ministered to me." And I think that that was the case. We ministered to one another. Isn't that right?
Hi, thanks for this, fantastic. I have kind of a complicated question that has to do with historiography and history making and maybe some insights from Leonard Arrington in terms of managing a kind of institutional prerogative to create a historical mythos that Arrington understood as, you know, contributing to devotional experience, and his, you know, I think, I can't remember which one of you said it, but his desire to create a kind of warts and all history, right? And striking a balance there seems to be so much of what he was about, and why I think we're all in the room kind of hero worshiping him, right? Is because we recognize both, and the need or the prerogative of it. Maybe people have different opinions about that, but finding a balance between history that is easily teachable and history that maybe provides us with some of that, for lack of a better word, meat, as we kind of expand in our own kind of historical understanding or maturity. Thanks.
So I mean, one of the greatest things about Leonard Arrington was this new history that he created, a world where the writing of history didn't have to be just faith-promoting gospel topics essays, but it could also be things that were challenging. And I think the greatest contribution that came out of Leonard Arrington's new Mormon history is Rough Stone Rolling. I think that's the greatest biography, sorry if you've written one, because I'm sure someone in here has, about Joseph Smith. Richard Bushman worked for Arrington during this time, and he started his work on Rough Stone Rolling at the time. So I think when we look at, and the Utah Historical Association is actually going to be doing a panel on Leonard Arrington and the writing and historiography and what it means to create history. But I think Arrington stands as a model of what it looks like. And I think there's plenty of examples in the diaries of the church fighting against Arrington, and especially Boyd K. Packer and Mark E. Peterson. He names drops them quite a bit as people who didn't like this new way of doing history. But Leonard Arrington was faithful till the end, and I think he showed a way that you can do this, and that history can be constructed in a way that's meaningful. It doesn't have to be faith-promoting, but it can still be meaningful. And I think that's the legacy of writing a history that's meaningful. Maybe not a history that is 100% objective or 100% faith-promoting, but it matters to people. And I just want to share a story real quick from Leonard Arrington, because it mattered to me a lot that I always have really bad imposter syndrome about my life, and I'm sure a lot of people in this room have felt that too. And Leonard Arrington always wrote his New Year's resolutions every single January, and they were the best thing to read in the diaries. He wrote his like favorites of the year and his New Year's resolutions, and one year he wrote that his mom said, "Can you write something that we're all going to like?" Story of my life.
Following Bill's regaling us with Leonard's experiences, I was 17. It was the summer between my junior senior year, and we'd gone on a family vacation to do genealogy. And I had looked in some books and read some things. Mainly it was about Parley Pratt and the Kirtland crisis. I'd never heard that before. So when we came back west, we stopped here in Salt Lake, and I had grown a beard that summer and long hair, which is sort of weird that I'm back to that again. But anyway, so I was standing in the church office building, and the list of the church historian's office was there. And I was looking, and church historian Leonard Arrington, and Ron Walker comes up to me, and he had those big, thick 70s glasses, and he was dressed in his suit and tie, and he said, "Young man, can I help you?" And being a smart aleck 17-year-old, I said, "Yeah, I'd like to see the church historian." And he said, "That'd be great. Why don't you come up with me?" So I got in the elevator, and I went upstairs. I think it was the second floor. Is that right? Yeah. And Ron takes me over to Leonard's secretary and says, "This young man would like to meet Brother Arrington." And she said, "I think I can work that out." And so she gets on the phone and calls Leonard and says, "We have a young man out here who would like to meet you." And again, that's a long, long time ago, so I don't recall. It seemed like it was forever. He made me feel completely comfortable. He was not rushing me. I mean, he walked over to his bookshelf as I was telling him my experience. He pulled out the story of the Latter-day Saints, and he said, "You need to get this book and read it." And I said, because I had asked him, I think, about Essentials in Church History. And he said, "Don't get that." And then that's when he grabbed Story of the Latter-day Saints. I didn't see Leonard again for probably 10 years. Oh, and by the way, I told Mike Quinn about this when he was a professor at BYU and I was a young student. And he said, "That's the way we were. That's what Leonard wanted us to be like." He said he wanted us to bring people in. And that's exactly what Leonard did. Is he brought. So anyway, I saw him 10 years later here at Sunstone, and he was the same way. He just would take you in and make you feel like a part of him. And he was a good man, good man.
Personal friends and one former work colleague worked in the church office building, and this is now kind of anecdotal, but one of them told me about a rather vitriolic interchange between Elder Packer and Elder Perry over certain historical issues. This has led me to think that when the church history functions were moved from Salt Lake down to the BYU, that there may have been, well, some decided differences of opinion amongst various apostles and members of the First Presidency about, if you will, honest but faith-promoting history. I'm just interested in any comments that the rest of you panelists might have on that subject.
The diaries do not, unless I've totally blanked it out, and in which case Gary will correct me, the diaries do not provide any indication that there were members of the Quorum of the Twelve that tried to defend or deflect that decision. As nearly as I could tell, Leonard only saw the results of it, which were Gordon B. Hinckley telling G. Homer Durham to disband the historical department, or as option B, move it to BYU and get it out of church headquarters. Is that more or less correct?
The impression that I have from working on the diaries is that it's really frustrating. Because it would be nice to know exactly what happened. Whose idea was it? How did this idea spread itself throughout the councils of the church to relocate the history division? Let me back up for just a minute. When Arrington came on, the church was undergoing, the church had hired a couple of Eastern, meaning non-LDS, management consultant companies to evaluate their organization, the administration of the church headquarters, and they were implementing some changes that would remove the quorum of the 12, members of the 12, from the day-to-day decision-making of the departments and appoint or hire department heads. As a result of that, the church historian's office became the church historical department, and the church historical department initially was comprised of three divisions. There was the church history division, the library division, and the archives division. Later there was historical sites. And Leonard Arrington, when he was called as church historian, he was also named the director of the church history division, and the church history division was specifically charged with writing quality, respectable church history. And one of their first assignments was the two books that became The Story of the Latter-day Saints and The Mormon Experience. And The Mormon Experience was specifically targeted for non-LDS readers, and The Story of the Latter-day Saints was specifically targeted for LDS readers. It's interesting to me that when Arrington was called and appointed as church historian, he was called and appointed only as the church historian, not as the church historian recorder. You know, I don't know why that was. There's talk in the diaries about what is the office of church recorder? Should he be the church historian and recorder? Or who is the recorder? What does the recorder do? And they typically said, we'll just leave it to you to figure that out. The impression that I have, and this is only an impression, is that when G. Homer Durham was named the managing director of the church historical department, he replaced Joseph Anderson. G. Homer Durham had always, from the beginning, thought that Leonard Arrington was not the church historian recorder occupying the same status as previous church historian and recorders. And I think that G. Homer Durham saw that as a mistake that had been made. And it wouldn't surprise me if the idea for relocating the church history division, and that was just the church history division, from church headquarters down to BYU was G. Homer Durham's idea. G. Homer Durham and Gordon B. Hinckley were longtime friends. They had been missionaries together in England. I don't think it would have taken that much to convince other people, including Gordon B. Hinckley, that this was the better way to go about handling the writing of church history, move it from Salt Lake City, move it from the church headquarters down to an academic environment. But that's just my impression. When I was working on annotating the diaries, I asked the church history library about access to G. Homer Durham's diaries. I ended up giving them specific dates. They supplied redacted transcriptions from those entries. So it was illuminating in some ways and really frustrating in other ways. But I'm very grateful that they supplied what they did.
Well, while I know some of the background on this change, if Arrington was alive today during the process of writing of the Gospel Topics essays, what might have been some of his feedback from your feelings on several months before her 15th birthday?
I was just going to use that example. Helen Marr would have been 14.
Somebody else going to respond?
So in regards to that specific question about those specific words, I think he would have argued, let's not do that. Let's be more honest about it. But I think he would have loved the majority of the essays.
I think that we talk about the importance of Leonard and his influence. I remember Wordsworth's the best portion of a good man's life are the little nameless, unremembered acts of kindness and love. And those certainly characterized Leonard. He was a man of jovial spirit, of immense good humor, and who took pleasure in the smallest kinds of things. He spent a year at UCLA when I was on the faculty there,
And during that time, got to know him. And at another time, he came and stayed in my house. And I remember him coming down in the morning saying how grateful he was to hear mockingbirds, that that took him back to the South. And I think those roots in the South and that experience was something that tempered a kind of graciousness and a kind of generosity that to me are as important as anything that he wrote or the kind of influence that he had, which I think is profound on modern Mormon history. But those little unremembered acts of kindness and love are things that I remember most about Leonard.
I'd like to know some of the most surprising things that are in the diaries.
Well, I suspect that everybody's going to have his or her own surprising things. So one of the surprising things to me is, again, this relates more to the personal side of Leonard Arrington, and that was after his wife, Grace, passed away, how lonely he felt. He was lonely and lost, and I was just kind of surprised to see that, probably because I put him on a pedestal and expected a different response and an ability to handle situations like that than was the case. But it was also reassuring to me in reading those portions that, you know, he struggled like we all do in certain kinds of situations. So seeing him really vulnerable was surprising to me, and I appreciated his willingness to talk about that in his diary.
I think that some people really don't understand how vulnerable Leonard was when Grace passed away. Leonard couldn't even boil water. His son, Carl, came over for several weeks and worked with him to try to teach him how to cook. This simply was not something that he did.
To me, I've said this comment time and again because it is the most surprising thing to me. I study Mormon fundamentalism mainly, and so the number one thing that stands out time and again is that Leonard Arrington affirmed the authenticity of the 1886 revelation and said it is in the vault of the First Presidency.
Just because this was mentioned, he did not chew tobacco. That was for medicinal purposes only. He had really bad... This is from two French explorers that came and interviewed Brigham Young, and they noticed how imperfect his front teeth were. They were decayed, and this was a dental treatment. Speaking as a dentist, I appreciated that.
All right. Well, thank you all. Thanks to the panel, and thank you for your comments and questions. It was a great session. Thank you.